Brothers, I'm very glad that you're able to be here today. And while, as you can see in the back of the bulletin, it is a mandate to mothers, I've tried to come up with a sermon that can be applicable to all of us. The holidays are kind of hard as a preacher because, you know, Mother's Day, you're supposed to interject something of mothers. You know, Father's Day is supposed to be something with fathers. Christmas, you have to come up with something new each year out of Luke 2 or something to that effect. Every Easter, you have to come up with something new or different out of 1 Corinthians 13. But so what I've done is I kind of thought it over and I prayed about it. And while I may be using the word mother a lot here, as you can see in the back of the bulletin there's a little outline. I think this is something that is applicable to all of us. Because, again, demographics have changed tremendously. It was in, I guess, just this week's paper in U.S. News and World, no, USA Today, Friday or Saturday's paper. If I'm foggy in these details, that's okay. If someone knows it, you can correct me. But like 41% now of all children in a single-parent home. So the old traditional home of mom staying home, rearing the kids, dad going out, getting a life's living wage is, I guess, pretty much becoming a thing of the past. And there's many reasons for it, some which maybe we can do nothing about. But then there's also the divorce stuff going on. So I know that the demographics of our culture in America has changed a lot, even in my lifetime. My mother was fortunately able to stay home with the first group of kids. There was three of us, and then there was a set of twins that came later on, and then she went back to work. But for most of my time, Mom was home with us all the day. And Moms did point us in a direction. It is true, as we have pointed on that wall there going into the nursery, Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way he shall go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. So I have a mandate for mothers, but as you all know, I think the mandate is applicable to all of us. But for mothers, especially now I'm using a little bit of my home, which maybe is not a good example, but there is just many miraculous things that go on in the home that I don't even know about. You know, I throw my clothes in this wicker basket in our bedroom, and somehow, miraculously, they all end up folded in my dresser drawer. And it's just amazing how that happens. You know, that pantry that we have there, it is perpetually filled. There seems like there's always leftovers in the refrigerator. And moms, you guys just have a tremendous task on you. And again, I don't even know if it's necessarily a fair task, because now it seems like more often than not, both spouses are working. And sometimes mom even maybe works more hours and have a further length or distance to commute. But when the dishes are to be done or the food is to be cooked, even though both spouses are working or whatever, who usually gets the privilege of doing it? And some of you ladies are laughing, and you men, you don't want to say anything. So I think the point is kind of well made that wives, I understand, and mothers, you have a tremendous responsibility. But one of the responsibilities that we have as parents is that we need to teach our children values. There are many, many values that we as parents need to be teaching them. And sadly, there are many competing values that are also seeking to be embraced by your child. And again, we heard some of them over the past couple months now in this training. So you and I, whether we're adults, whether we're children, whether they're parents, we need to be cautious as to what values we are going to embrace. And as parents, we must always be diligent to teach the right values and be vigilant against the wrong values that are seeking to be embraced by our children. Let me give you a little bit of what in the world am I talking about, because some of you are thinking, where is he going with this? Glad you asked. First of all, here's some of the random samples of values we need to teach our children. We need to teach them to share. That's one of the basic ones, but it's so necessary in life. Self-denial is another biggie. The physical impulses need to be denied. And again, we know whether even in adulthood, people who have a much harder life because their physical impulses have not been denied. I want that glass of water, Mommy, and I want it now. And don't let me wait. You must stop everything that you're doing and get me that water now. Kind of like somebody in the Old Testament. I'm really hungry, and I want that bowl of porridge now. Consequences, who cares? Just give it to me now. There's the sensory impulses. There's the emotional impulses. You know, many people as adults have not been able, they have not learned to control their emotions. And some of them are flying high one day, and then they're down in the pits the next day. They're happy-go-lucky. You'd love to be with them one day, and the next day they're Attila the Hun. And they've just never learned to control their emotions. And then we kind of blame shift and we come up with all kinds of quote-unquote scientific reasons for that, but they just never learned self-denial. They've never learned to control and keep the body under subjection and bringing thoughts, etc., into obedience. Obedience is another one. First-time obedience with the right attitude, both to God and to man. And we again can see in our culture today there is just an antinomianism out there. There's just an anti-authority. You got to be kidding me. Nobody is telling me what to do. I don't care if it's my parents. I don't care if it's the Bible. I don't care if it's my boss. I don't care if it's the church leadership. Nobody's telling me what to do. And we then have a whole younger generation of kids, especially, that are just going to have a very hard, difficult time with not learning how to obey the first time with the right attitude. Service. Service. Loving God, loving neighbors. You know, it used to be back in the day where, you know, we as neighbors would get together and we would help one another, we'd do for one another, we'd watch one another kids, we'd run over and let the neighbor's dog out or feed their horses. If a neighbor's horse got out, it doesn't matter, it's a, I suppose, an illustration that's kind of foreign to most of us here. But there was a neighborhood that was going on. Nowadays, it's literally every man for themselves. And we put up our nice 6-foot-high stockade fences, and it's just about us. But we need to be teaching our children that we need to be loving our neighbors. We need to teach our children to be doing for others. We need to teach them to sacrifice. To sacrifice. Doing without. For the benefit of a greater cause. What would be a couple greater causes for which we maybe should teach our children to sacrifice? Anybody have any ideas? What would be some greater causes than them for which they should sacrifice? Yes. Excellent example. Buying the Bible for the Trio Indians. Any other examples? There's many. I would say God. How do we sacrifice for God? Well, through the church. I would say just for the benefit of the others, Mother's Day. I got my allowance. I can go spend it on me or I could go spend it on Mom. But Mom, I don't know. We're not such a good relationship with Mom right now because she wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do. You know where we're going with this. The work ethic. Colossians chapter 3. We need to teach our children a good work ethic. It's kind of funny, as we were working through that, we had some employers who normally don't even come to the church happen to go through here, and I think just about every one of the employers said, I wish my employees would be here. In fact, one of the guys owns a business in Pendle, and he said, even my best employee doesn't have anywhere near the work ethic that you talked about today. Well, who's going to teach them? Mom and Dad. We need to teach them a work ethic. We need to teach them good taste. They need to be able to appreciate quality in the arts. Teach them quality and to appreciate that in literature. To teach the appreciation of quality in music. Somehow I just missed out on abstract art. I took the Ukrainians and the glasses, the Buntsevs and the glasses to the Museum of Art, and we got in on Picasso. Now, I enjoyed his impressionist work. But that French avant-garde type stuff with just the abstract. But then you guys know I'm not the smartest guy. But just to throw stuff on canvas, no rhyme or reason. I just missed that. I never taught that appreciation and that quality, because obviously it's expensive stuff, so there must be quality to that, but I missed that. Well, we need to be teaching our children to appreciate quality, the quality of things in life, not just other stuff. Teach them to be organized. That would be a value. To be organized in their rooms, their toys, organized in their bags, their school bags, their homework. To be a good steward of their present possessions. Bicycles should not be just dumped when they get off it in the middle of the driveway. We should stand them up on the kickstand. That's why they're there. You should put them in the garage or put them somewhere. You just don't hop off the bike. You don't do some of the terrible things that my brother and I did to some of our toys. We were not good role models. We had a destructive mentality, and we had all kinds of resources, and friends had gunpowder, and we just did all kinds of stupid stuff with toys. Blowing things up was a highlight of our life. Gas was inexpensive, so we would have a gasoline trail to a bunch of... Doesn't matter. It really doesn't. But stewardship, but somewhere in the process, someone needs to teach the children that these are not your possessions. These things that you are blowing up and burning and trashing and leaving out to rust, they're not yours. Because going back to the first of the year, and going back to this thing that's sitting here, whose do they belong to? It's God's. It's all about God. So you need to be good stewards, and we need to teach our children that. We need to teach another value of academics. We need to train and sharpen their minds for the better understanding and the usage of the Bible. They need to be able to think intellectually and logically and rationally, be able to understand this book, so that they can go and further the cause of Jesus Christ. The social skills and manners, which nowadays are just about non-existent. Who goes first? When you're at a restaurant, who orders first? When you introduce people, to whom do you introduce to whom? There is some protocol and things of that nature. The please, the thank you, you're welcome. Some of you here recently have experienced the frustrations of, how many people RSVP nowadays? About zero, right? We just don't RSVP anymore. So we're planning parties or whatever. Please just tell me if you're coming or not. And no one RSVPs. Well, people need to be taught that. They need to be taught those manners. Writing thank you notes, etc. Vocabularies. Is there anything else in the English language besides slang, cliches, euphemisms? Is there some deeper, more meaningful words and vocabularies we can use other than just what the vulgar stuff that goes around all the time that we talked about that? If you subtracted about 5 or 6 words from some people's vocabulary, they could not even speak. And that's their limited vocabulary. When they're excited, they use it. When they're mad, they use it. They have such a limited vocabulary. And I know the English language is not one of the romantic languages, but it's the language we got. And we should be able to expand the vocabulary and teach the children that. Attitudes. And we need to teach our children good attitudes. The spiritual disciplines. Spiritual truth. We need to teach them about God. Who is God? And again, for many, we have trouble with that. What does He do? What does He expect from us? What does He reward? What does He punish? We need to teach our children the need for salvation. They need to be saved. Now, again, is there knee-high to a grasshopper, some of these cliches? We need to teach them that even though they don't quite understand the need of salvation, every single person is in need of salvation. And that salvation is because of sin. And even that young little child, again, we've got some younger, and I've not seen them get in car seats, but I know my 2 children, and you put them in car seats, they would stiffen just like that. So you kind of push on their waist, and you hold them in their waist, and you try to buckle those snaps. That's rebellion. That's seminal sin. And just wait till that becomes full-blown. So you need to deal with it in the car seat, or when it gets full-blown, then you really got trouble. But there's penalty for that sin. And we know the penalty of that sin. with some of the references that we learned last year. What are the wages of sin? We have a Christless eternal damnation in hell. And we need to teach children that. We need to teach them that who is the only one who can save them from hell forever? God, the Son, Jesus Christ. And He did that through His death, His burial, His resurrection. So we need to teach them that they can be saved from the penalty of sin. Our kids need to learn that they can be saved from the power of sin. That's what Romans 4, 5, 6, and 7 is all about. Why in the world? Well, let's just not go there. There's many implications to the power of the resurrection of Jesus Christ as He conquered death, as He conquered sin. And then one day, and we're all looking forward to this, that we'll be saved from the very presence of sin. And we need to teach our children, again, as Colossians says, do not set your mind and affections on things on this earth. Because again, aren't we graphically reminded how transitory the possessions here on earth are? What happened in Kentucky? There was somebody here in our church that was planning on going to the Grand Ole Opry. That ain't going to happen. Not anytime soon. My understanding is there's $170-some million worth of damage to the Grand Ole Opry. But yet it happens like that all the time. And yet we spend our lives literally working for stuff that within a matter of a few inches of rain is gone. And your whole life is gone. Like, what is with that? We need to be setting our focus and our attention on things above, and we need to teach the kids that. All right, let me make just a little switch here, and then we'll get into the message here today. When our children were younger, and maybe you guys don't do that anymore, but when we were younger back, what would be the first phone number that we would teach our children apart from our favorite takeout restaurant? So, apart from that, what would be the phone number that we'd all teach our children? Okay, now why do we teach them 911? Because in event of emergency, they would know how to go and get help. And we teach them 911 so that if something would happen, they would know what to do. And that would be to call 911. Well, as you can see in the back of the bulletin, where we're going now in most of this here is that we need to teach our children a subject that is oftentimes overlooked, ignored, overtly or just deliberately. And we need to teach them what to do with suffering. Our life is full of suffering. And the older we get, the more we end up suffering. How is one to suffer? How is a believer supposed to suffer? Or how does one learn how to handle suffering? And while this subject of teaching someone that we love the subject of how to suffering, the reality of it cannot be ignored. Daycare trauma. How many of you parents just love dropping your kids off at daycare? We don't. Well, why? Because stuff happens there. The teasing at school in elementary. How many, you know, those of you who are parents, we know, and our heart breaks when the kids come home because they're being teased, you know, too tall, too fat, too skinny, too whatever, hair too short, hair too long, not the latest fashions, their ears, their nose, whatever's too big, too small, sticks out or whatever. And all this stuff that comes at them and it breaks our heart, but we sit down with them and we say, this is a lesson you got to learn. Now, I'm sorry you have to learn it in elementary school, but trust me, there are some people who have never learned it, and you need to learn this lesson. As they get a little older, you've got the abuse from the neighborhood kids. You got the fighting going on sometimes in your own house. And then there's just the inequity and the unfairness of life. How many of us have never heard, it's not fair? And what do we respond to that? Well, you better get used to it, because guess what? Life is not fair. It really isn't. Do you know that God sends the rain on both the just and the unjust? What's with that? You'd think that God would be frying them. But that's not fair. So, yes, you're right, son. You're right, daughter. Life is not fair. Now, let me show you how to handle that biblically. And I'm just going to give you a brief little idea out of Habakkuk. Now, we need to teach and train our children how to handle suffering. Job said this. In Job chapter 3, verse 25, he said, the thing that I dreaded, The thing that just kept me up late at night, the thing that I had feared now has come upon me. Job knew that there could be some hard days coming. And unfortunately, when he lost it all, then he wrote this. He knew that. Now, from these thoughts, these were just not idle thoughts. These were just not restless nights. Job was able to formulate a process of how to handle suffering in his life so that when all was taken away from him, we got Job chapter 1. And in Job chapter 1, Job, after he hears all this stuff, he gets up there, he tears his clothes, he shaves his head, he puts on ashes, he grieves. He says, "Naked I came into this world, and naked I'm going out of this world." He says, "The Lord has given me the cattle, the Lord has given me my children, the Lord has given me the servants, and He's taken them away. He's given to me, that's His right. He's taken His children away, and that's right. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And on the bottom of the screen there, how do you handle that? The way he was supposed to. Now, the reason he was able to say that is found in chapter 3. "The thing that I had greatly feared, that which I was not looking forward to, had come. But now that it's come, I have prepared. And subsequently, my natural default mode, because of my training, is the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." The reality of suffering. The reality of suffering. You know, moms, we need to teach the reality of suffering. All those who live godly in Christ Jesus, we are going to suffer persecution. Jesus said, "In this world you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." As we read there in Matthew chapter 10, you know, there is going to be, because of religion, fighting in the home. And brothers are going to turn brothers in to the authority. And there's going to be division and conflict, some of which even happened in our church over Easter. Whereas believers, we just can't celebrate Easter like some of the other family members. And there's going to be a division, and there's words and things of that nature on their part. But we understand that we're not all just going to be one big, loving, happy family. Because there's truth. And the truth, sometimes, if people don't want to align themselves with it, then there's going to be some difference. And then again, you know, we just have this basic principle that we all live in a sinful world. And one of the consequences of sin is that there's going to be suffering. The possible responses to suffering are many. Now, again, the question is not if we're going to suffer. Because you can say, "Well, you know, I'm not going to live godly in Christ Jesus." Okay, that's fine. But you still live in this sinful world. And there's going to be suffering. So it's not if, but how. Well, again, there's run. Sometimes I feel like the psalmist, "Oh, that I had the wings of a dove. That I could fly out of here and just be at rest. Man, I wish that I could just go up, homestead some property up there in Alaska somewhere, get my 160 acres, and forget about all these people, and I'd just be at rest. Just run away." Sometimes we do that. Sometimes we try to mask it, the chemicals, the drugs. Sometimes we fight it. There's the anger, the bitterness, the retaliation. Sometimes we endure, but we endure not with joy. We embrace this martyr complex. Then there's the old standby that we all use. "God, if you loved me, God, I thought you were a God of love. If you loved me, if you were a God of love, God, how could you let this happen?" That's another way to deal with it. Let's look at the way the prophet dealt with it, though. Habakkuk. And maybe I should have given you a little hint to try to find that. If you can find Matthew, just back up a few pages. So you may not want to try to find it in the Old Testament, because that's kind of hard and it's just a couple pages. But in Habakkuk, I want to show you very quickly how Habakkuk handled suffering. Go to Matthew, then just back up to the back just a few pages. In Habakkuk chapter 1, we have a man who is just like you and I. He is absolutely confused. It doesn't make any sense at all. There's no rhyme, there's no reason, there's no logic. It just doesn't make sense to him. And he's complaining. And as you can see there, they're up on the screen maybe as well. He says, "Oh Lord, how long shall I cry? God, don't you listen? And you will not hear. Even cry out to you violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me this iniquity? Why do I have to see what you're going to do to your people? And cause me to see trouble, for plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and violence are before me. There is strife and contentions arises. Therefore, the law is powerless." Ooh, that's quite an accusation. "And justice never goes forth." Well, I'll tell you what. These accusations, you know, no one likes these accusations to be accused of something, but he is really giving it to God. The wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. You can see that he's making some pretty sharp accusations to God. He says, "God, you do not hear. God, you do not save. God, you are allowing me to experience trouble. You're allowing the righteous to suffer. You are allowing justice to be perverted." And God, as you look at verse 13, he says, "You are purer of eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously?" God, you're just sitting around doing nothing. What is wrong with you, God? And the accusations are just flying. And it just doesn't make any sense. Now, we have the privilege of history. And we know what God is doing. God is going to take the Babylonians and he's going to allow the Babylonians to come in and to plunder and to destroy, to purify his people and to bring them back into a proper relationship with him. But that was just shocking to Habakkuk. That perplexed him. That confused him. He didn't understand that. But yet, notice the mercy of God. And this is, again, that just is astounding. You know, when people come and make, and they're all false accusations. So if someone comes up to you and makes some rather serious accusations that are unfounded, how do you handle that? Get a little upset, get a little annoyed. But here we've got a holy, pure God. And look at how God responds to him. He says there in prayer, he begins to pray for them. While being accused for him, he answers him in chapter 1, verse 5. And in chapter 1, verse 5, it says, "Look and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your day, which you would not believe, though it were told to you." And it's just the grace and the mercy of God here coming out. It's kind of a little aside that rather than just frying him, he says, "You know what? Let me tell you what's going on. Even though you're not having any faith in me, even though you're making all these accusations against me, I will humor you and I will tell you what is going on." But there's something that's going on here. There's something now that's going on in Habakkuk's life. And there's a great transformation that's taking place. But let's jump to chapter 3. The prophet's response. He begins with complaining. He begins with confusion. But then he goes to being earnest and he prays. Notice again, chapter 3, verse 1. The prayer, a prayer of Habakkuk. Verse 2. "O Lord, I heard your speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy." Let's take just a few quick moments and tear this prayer of Habakkuk apart as to see if there's some lessons we can learn as to how we should handle suffering, trouble. First of all, as you can see, maybe also as well on your bulletin, yeah, near the bottom of that, his focus is not on self, but his focus is on God. Look at verse 2. "O Lord, your speech. O Lord, your work." The only personal pronoun there is in the second word, "I heard." And then it's all about God. And there's a huge fundamental shift in our thinking that must occur. And that we must teach individuals, children, loved ones in suffering, that after we get through that confused and complaining stage, which hopefully won't be very long, we then will go to earnest prayer and it ceases to become about us. And it starts to become all about God. As again, as you look at verse 2, he says, it's your plans, God. It's your work, God. It's not about me. It's not God. This is messing up my agenda. You know, God, how can I go and do this if I have this? God, don't you understand? You know, if you'd let me win the lottery, you know, I could give 10% to the church and we could build a new building just like that. You know, God, just work with my plans. But Habakkuk isn't praying that. He has removed himself from the equations and he says, your work, God. I want to see your work going on. And then notice also, his focus is not on justice, but it's on mercy. Mercy. God, be merciful. In chapter 3, verses 3 through 15, he becomes focused and he becomes yielding. And how he did that was, again, as you look at chapter 2 and read through chapter up to the first part of chapter 3, there is kind of a chronological history lesson of all that God has done. So when you and I get into trouble, we need to start going back to our prayer journals. When you and I get into trouble, we need to go back, as we are told to do in the New Testament, study the prophets. We need to get out our Bibles and we need to start studying them. And he focused on the past acts of God. And that brought him to the point where you and I will want to be. He then yielded his plans and purposes to God, which might have brought initial pain, but brings about greater good. And we see that there in Hebrews 12. And in Hebrews 12, we've got this, you know, whom the Lord loves, he chastens. And it says very clearly there that the present suffering is not pleasant. But what does it do at the end? It does bring about that peaceable fruit of righteousness. And then again, the last few words are kind of interesting. Who are trained. So you can't be fighting it. You got to let it do its work in you. And then he is quiet and he is waiting. He starts out perplexed. He starts out complaining. He then starts praying. And it's not no longer about, or it's not anymore about him, but it's you, God. It's your work. It's your plans. It's your purposes. He's focused on that. And then we get down to verse 16, and he has a promise that God will be vindicated. But here's what he didn't have. While he had the promise, he didn't have the date. And again, if we had a little more time, which maybe I shouldn't spend some time at the beginning of the sermon, but I'm sure there's some of you and I that we have a promise of God, but we didn't get the date. And we are just in all agitation about that. And we're saying, you know, God, you know this goofy prayer list here that I have, and I've been praying for this for a long time. God, where's the date? Well, where is the date? Where is your promise? Is the law of no good anymore, as he accuses God in chapter 1? The promise is still there. He just didn't give you the date. And why in the world does God have to work according to our time frame? So don't get stressed about the date. Claim the promise. Be quiet. And wait. We have a promise, don't we? We just read it. We know that all things will work together for good to them that love God. A couple of qualifications. You got to be loving Him. If you're living a life of a rebel, good luck with that. You got to be called according to His purposes, not yours. But if you allow God to be working in your life, it will work out for good. But you know, quite honestly, in the history of Oxford Valley Chapel, there have been a few things that have happened that I've still not yet seen the good come out of it. I haven't. We've lost various people. We've not yet seen anyone come in, take up their place. In my mind, as of right now, today, there is no good that has come out of it. So does that mean Romans 8:28 is lying? He just hasn't given me the date. Now, He's got the date. I don't have it. So what we need to do is we need to learn and teach others to be like Habakkuk, and that is just be quiet and wait. And then lastly, he's humble and he's rejoicing. And again, this is kind of almost a paradox. Because Hezekiah, when he's writing this, is not like he's in denial, or he's on some chemical or drugs, and he's delusional, he knows full well what's going to happen. The Babylonians are going to come in, and they're going to take everything. They're going to take the crops. They're going to take the animals. There's going to be rape, murder, plunder, pillage. And when you take the crops and you take the seed corn, what are you going to plant the next year? You're going to be in trouble. If you kill all the animals, how long is it going to take before you get some milk again? It'll be a while. So he knows that it's not just going to be the immediate invasion, but there's going to be subsequent hunger and suffering for a long time. Yet in the midst of all of that, he says, and you can see that there in Habakkuk chapter 3, he says, verse 17, though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no fruit, though the flock may be cut off from the field, and there is no herd in the stalls, it's going to be a long time before we get some cheese. Yet I will rejoice. And who is he rejoicing in? It's not the suffering. It's not himself. It's not his plans. I'm rejoicing in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. So here we have a man who's gone from an angry, confused, complaining prophet to now a man who has faith and trust in God. And he is at last liberated from superficial, circumstantial happiness. He has been liberated from superficial, circumstantial happiness. The source and the object of his rejoicing is God. God himself has finally become enough. Enough. He has found joy in God alone. And here alone is where you and I will find joy in the midst of our severest suffering. It is in God and him alone. So, just a couple of real quick applications and I'm done. How well have you prepared for suffering? We are going to suffer. It's going to happen. How well have you prepared your children for suffering? Husbands, those of you who are married, you are to sanctify your wife. How have you prepared her for suffering? When the circumstances seem to contradict God's character and promises, because this just don't make no sense. This isn't right. What do we do? When the circumstances seemingly contradict God's character and God's promises, what do we do? When suffering, do we provide God with time constraints? I do. My God, and I say it, you've heard me say this before, God, in my lifetime as a believer, you have never let me go over the cliff. Never has he let me go over the cliff. Now, he's brought me to the precipice several times, but he's never brought me over the cliff. So, like, God, let's skip this. You and I know where you're going to come through, so you don't have to keep bringing me to the cliff every time. But let's just skip that. You just come through, okay? You're going to do it anyway. So I do put time constraints on him. But really, should we? Is it right for us to demand that God fulfills his promises according to my schedule? And then just one more. In the midst of suffering, is your focus solely on your deliverance? Is there any thought given to what God might be doing? Because again, you've heard me say before, where is God? Where is God in this? Heads bowed, eyes are closed.